Of Fulton Civilization Site. I'm Michael Lewin, as usual, your favorite site owner. Daniel Quick, Dan Q, is here with me. Say hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
I knew you were going to do that.
That's probably why you asked.
You are so predictable. And instead of Imran this week, you get Anthony, better known as Dolphin on our forums.
Hello.
And, well, it was a little bit slow news week, but we have a few things to talk about, as usual. Because, you know, you put three people in a room, we blather on about Civ, you know.
But not in the same room.
Well, okay, the same virtual chat room. You're so technical today. A lot of people aren't reading the Polycatch form.
Well, except the only people reading the forum and listening to the show are those who don't want to listen to the show or read the forum.
Yeah, it's kind of backwards, isn't it?
It is. But
that's good advertising, though.
Well, yes. I mean, if hates it, then it must be good.
Oh, this is not just something you said last time. No one is getting my measurements. Period.
Oh, but all your admirers know, at least those you went out on the dates with. We're still trying to find out who they are, by the way.
I haven't been going out with any admirers. I've been
right here. Bow wow. Oh, okay.
Need sound effects guy, too.
Thank you for your day job.
This is a job? What? We're getting paid? I was never informed.
This week's news, we'll talk about the previews of Galaxy 2 Dark Avatar and some more assorted awards for Galaxy 2, as well as Warlords and the Editor's Top 10 and IGN. Warlords and Galaxy 2 both recommend for families by GamerDad.com. And also at the very end, I'll have for you a brief and, well, rather brief, report on the state of democracy games here at Appleton.
We also go into our vault of completed archive segments for a news item discussion from our first pilot last September that was not included in the final run. It's on Civilization 4 as an educational tool, good or bad.
In this week's modcast, we discuss the topics of the barbarian state and obsolete resources.
In this week's Senate, we look at our favorite Civ 4 labor civic, followed by Mackie and Anthony being given an opportunity to talk about their favorite government and legal civic. And we also look at our favorite map type in Civilization 4. And in the research lab, we look at nuclear war.
So on to the news then.
The first item, Dark Avatar previews at both IGN and GamesRadar. Well, this IGN article, written by longtime contributor Steve Butts, who apparently has his own blog on IGN, but who really cares, prefaces by writing that Galactic Civilizations 2 Dreadlords very nearly did for sci-fi empire games what Civilization 4 did for the historical segment of the genre, thanks to loads of depth and variability with a slick and convenient interface. Now, if by did for historical segment of turn-based strategy games, Steve, you mean renew its lease on life, then I agree with your assessment for Civ 4, but wonder why he falls short of saying the same thing for Gal Civ 2. On its own, it accomplished this. I mean, let alone that it had no comparable game set in the sci-fi genre to compete with. There's no discussion of the campaign that's included with the Dark Avatar expansion because it's not available.
Put it in the demo.
Yeah, so that's probably why they're not talking about it. So hopefully maybe in a later preview we'll hear about it. But we do know that Dark Avatar starts in a galaxy dominated by the Trengen Empire, where the other galactic races, including the Terran Alliance, the humans, have little hope of maintaining their independence or even surviving. But the Trengen Empire is fracturing, as the different factions of the Empire disagree over how to rule over all of their conquered peoples. Most of them want enslaved, but one faction wants them eliminated altogether. You know, I start reading the background story for Galciv 2 and Dark Avatar, and I think, what a perfect platform for a series of fiction books like was done with Alpha Centauri. Anybody read those books?
I think I read the excerpts.
Not me.
They were good, though.
Of course, there was a mention of a character named Marcos in those books, but There was no Dan. I'm not better.
I'll never forgive you, Michael.
No, I just... What's interesting is that there are two new civilizations, empires, that you can play in Galciv 2. I think that's pretty well standard with an expansion pack for a title like this, to add some new races. There's the better word I should be using, races, not civilizations. This splinter group from the Drengen Empire is called the Koroth Clan. Sounds awfully Star Trek-y to me, which is thumbs up in my book. They have this super annihilator ability with spore ships that can eliminate all life on a planet and render it completely uninhabitable. Nice guys.
Someone set them up the bomb?
What's the weapon called?
I just know it as the super annihilator ability. I'm not sure they actually have a specific name.
Oh, they need a good name for it.
The Fist of God.
It's like the Death Star or something.
We could have a copyright problem or some hate mail if we used either of those two titles. But hey, we're thinking.
Well, it was a good name for Planet Busters in Alpha Centauri.
True, but talking about Alpha Centauri means also talking about Electronic Arts. Oh.
Oh, the Evil Empire?
Hey, tie-in!
The Death Star.
Tie-in! But if you're interested in playing one of these new civilizations and don't like the sound of the Koroth clan, there is a less xenophobic but more religiously fanatical Kryn consulate. They're the other new race, and they begin games with an espionage agent and counter-espionage technology.
Kind of reminds me of a cross between, like, the Believers and the Peacekeeper. No, maybe the Believers and the Data Angels out of Alpha Centauri and its expansion.
Indeed. Indeed. And what's also nice about the Dark Avatar expansion is that every race is getting something new. We're not just adding new races and forgetting about perhaps advancing or progressing what's going on with the other races. Each race in Galciv 2, Dark Avatar, comes with a new super ability that reflects their character. Each ability is tied to a specific race, but you're free to pick from all of them if you're designing your own race. Lots of options there.
Yeah, I was going to say, what does that mean? I can sit there and make a race and I want all the extra powers.
Yes, but then if you choose all of the powers, then they cancel each other out and you have nothing. Good job. I really don't know if that's true, but I thought that sounded good.
I was going to say, that sounds like a Dan designed little thing there.
It's coming. And unlike the first Civ 4 expansion, Warlords, there are several diplomatic additions to the Galciv 2 universe we're talking about. Most extensively, the espionage units, but also two new diplomatic options with their own economic impacts. Yes, I know there's vassal states, and that has some impact in diplomacy, but really, Warlords was not about the diplomacy. Forgiven, you are.
About getting a bigger stick.
Now I'm channeling Yoda for some reason. I've gone from Star Trek to Star Wars. Ooh. I'm going to make fans all over the place. Battlestar Galactica.
Just need to mention Stargate movie in.
In a as-of-yet-unreleased pilot of Polyclast, we talked about the then plan to include mega events. And they've materialized. Woo!
Oh, we have specifics on them now?
Or there are mega events.
Oh, I see. This is fun. Final confirmation that there are mega events, not that... And here's what they are.
Sorry for seeing stupid, but what is a mega event?
It's something like the random events you would get in Alpha Centauri, where you would have outburst of mind worm activity, or bases would have like an outbreak of a virus or something, but on a bigger scale, of course, because Galciv is not just one place, but it's a number of systems.
Yes, in short, life happens.
Hence the mega.
Or we can use another word in there if you want to, but then...
I think we'd have to bleep that one.
Yes, I would have to censor myself. That doesn't sound like fun. Or does it?
You know you want to play with the duct tape.
But it's not shiny.
One side of it's shiny. The other side is sticky, though. And it hurts when you pull it off.
Those are lots of good and bad points. I'm torn. Ooh, torn with tape. Ooh, what a very sad tie-in or something.
Yeah.
And then just very briefly, the Games Radar article is written by Troy Goodfellow, who, representing Computer Games Magazine, was the only media reporter to cover a PolyCon 06 held last July in Maryland. Good for you, Troy.
Did he ever actually write anything about it?
Yes, he did. And it appeared. In Computer Games Magazine, someone isn't reading the PolyCon forum. But then again, you're not the only one. And Dark Avatar can be your Valentine this year, for it's scheduled to be released on February 14th. Oh. What a way to show your...
How romantic.
What a way to show your sweetheart you love them if you had one. Warlord in Editor's Top 10. I really didn't have a lot to say about that one.
Not much other than Jade Feet Oblivion.
But man, this article is also written by Steve Butts at IGN.
Yeah, I think the point to make is it's only number 3.
Yes. But the two games ahead of it are pretty good. You know, so it's not dissing it to call it number 3.
Mm. Yeah. I've got number 1. Never heard of number 2.
I know a few people playing number 2. Company of Heroes is number 2, and Medieval 2 Total War was number 1.
And speaking of this article, Steve mentions Galactic Civilizations 2 Dreadlords under the Other Notables category. Oh, Steve, I'm sorry. You put Gal Civ 2 and say it reinvigorated the 4X space empire genre with new levels of polish and depth, which more or less match what you said about Gal Civ 2 in the Dark Avatar preview, yet it reinvigorates the 4X space genre, but it's only worthy of a Other Notables category. What are we doing here? I mean, we've got this Marvel Ultimate Alliance at number 5. First of all, it's a console title. Please.
Well, I'm looking at Guitar Hero at number 10. How the hell did that get on there?
Yes,
sorry,
I'm
allowed to say hell.
That's okay. Not only that, but what is this Okami at number 9? Your interaction with the world is handled through your manipulation of a celestial brush that can be used to alter the reality around you?
You just want to hate on it because it's PlayStation 2.
Well, that helps to hate, but...
In your mind.
Take an art class. I mean, come on. Okami, number 9? No, I don't think so.
Indeed.
The next Gal Civ 2 mention, everybody saw that, was on UGO, Chris Radke. I'm not even sure how to pronounce your last name. I'm sorry, Chris. It seems like you're missing a vowel in there. Chris, he calls it the second best games of 2006 because, quote, every best of 2006 list we've seen out there is packed with the same old crap, unquote. So I guess he decided they would repackage the same old crap and give it a different name. You know, I agree with Chris that Gal Civ 2 Stardock has unseated Master of Orion 2 Battle at Antares as the best space set game in the turn-based strategy genre. But I think he goes just a little too far, in my view, when he says that Gal Civ 2 is the new king of the turn-based grand strategy arena. I mean, sure, he offers apologies to Cid, but not only do I doubt he means he's sorry, but I think he should be saying sorry to Sorin just as much, if not more. Have you played Civ 4, Chris? I mean, Gal Civ 2 is great, but Civ 4 is just that much better, right?
Oh, definitely. I'm going to play Gal Civ.
We don't have the basis for a comparison. Other than we know, we like Civ.
I think the third award in this lineup is my favorite for how ridiculous it strikes me. Did you see Gal Civ 2 on Voodoo Extreme is their 2006 Underdog of the Year? Gal Civ 2 was an underdog? I mean, had Voodoo Extreme wrote this for the original Gal Civ back in 2004, when everyone, including Stardock, even admitted Master of Orion 3 is going to kick our behind, I would have been supportive of that.
Yeah, but outside of the strategy gaming people, it isn't as well known as something like Master of Orion. It's not a recognized name. I think that's what although it's a good game and there's a lot of people playing it, it hasn't really gotten that name recognition. Like you say, Civilization, even people who only lightly play strategy go, oh, I know that.
I don't like your logic.
What? What's wrong with my logic? It's logical.
I think it's crazy that Gal Civ 2 is named Underdog of the Year. I think they should have gotten another award. Mackie disagrees with me. Anthony, I guess you're the breaking vote.
Well, I've got to go with Underdog.
And Anthony forgets who invited him here. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to put you on mute
while
you think about what you said.
I'll just take away from your post, Cam.
I'll buy Poly Plus. Oh, got me over a barrel.
That's what we do.
I'm trying. Oh, you're not talking to me. And then John J. Callahan writes in the top 5 games of 2006 on Firing Squad and gives Gal Civ 2 the 3rd spot. Okay. But, you know, when gaming age or multiplayer is increasingly a rage, I think Callahan's boldest statement here, in my view, is when he says that Gelsif 2 is, quote, one of the few games out there that we don't mind the omission of a multiplayer mode, unquote. I don't think people necessarily mind, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't like to see it, right? I mean, not that I would play it, because multiplayer, the AI already knows how bad I am, like I want the rest of the world to know, right?
I'm sure there's someone out there worse than you.
Warlords and Galsif 2 recommended for families over at GamerDad. Yeah, okay, these news items are a bit dated, late May for the Galsif 2 review and last September for Warlords from last year, but hey, they're news to us, so there. While any review on GamerDad includes general discussion that you would expect and anticipate from reviews elsewhere, it is for that reason a focus on their Kid Factor segment, which I think is very much their writer's specialty. So I'm looking at the Galsif 2 one first. I'm going to go in chronological order here. Reviewer Bernie Dye gives it the site's authority badge for children 10+. He notes the heavy use of fictional warfare, but it isn't gory, so he's not particularly concerned about that. He's more concerned with the game's general complexities, deferring to parents to know whether or not their 10-year-old son or daughter would be able to enjoy this type of game with the learning curve that is involved at the outset.
You know, there are some pretty smart 10-year-olds.
Hmm. Well, how complex is it?
Well, if it's probably along the same line to you, maybe. I don't think you're going to get some kindergarten kid sitting down to
that
play.
Complex.
An older kid, you know, preteen kid, would probably be able to play it pretty easily. I mean, at least at the first. You try to go up levels, and then it gets a little more complex. But the same is true as Civ.
Yes, now true in Civilization IV, just briefly jumping to that GamerDad article from managing editor Michael Anderson, he talks about that, for example, on the Settler level, you can make terrible mistakes and still end up winning the game. That was news to me. Yes, yes, it was.
Well, you learn by your mistakes, don't you?
Yes, yes, I do. And I think...
Hypothetically.
Yeah, hypothetically. Anyway, back to the Galsif 2 article. The game forces players, children, and adults alike to ask difficult questions. What are the costs of going to war? And as the reviewer points out, some parents might not like their children thinking about these things. But, quote, the questions the game makes players ask are the things young minds should learn to think about, and the things they may need to ask as adults. Yes, such as when children are no longer children, they're adults, they will see a game that they want on the shelf, and they'll think, who's going to buy this game for me now?
Do I have enough money to buy it? That's an economic decision.
Do I really need to eat today?
Can I live on ramen noodles for the next 2 weeks?
Snacks are good in a moderation.
Ever fight a land war in Asia? What would be the gals equivalent? Do I still need this main planet of mine?
Finally, in the news, a democracy game report out of Bolton. Oh, Mackie, what can you tell us? Tell us all the dirty secrets.
Well, that's just the thing. I have to keep the dirty secrets to myself.
No one else is listening.
You never know. Well, the thing about with the two Intersight games is really, I can't say much other than they're still alive and they're still going pretty well.
Who's winning?
Well, nobody at this point because it's still too early on both of them. They're both still in the BCs.
So is that why you think both games are still going? Because nobody knows who's going to win?
I know. And, Patty the Scott on our forums has helped out a little bit on with the Civ 3 game, keeping it going. He's very good at poking democracy games along. Let's see, and the Civ 4 regular game, single-player game, ended back in December, and they got domination victory in 1828, and they got the Augustus Caesar rating, so they did a very good job there. I haven't planned out another vanilla one yet, but they're going to try and do a Warlords one. There's actually already a forum for it. It's not quite organized just yet. I think everyone's concentrating on the team democracy game right now, which I've got the same problem here that I had with the Intersight game. I can't tell you what's going on, really, except it's going.
Very good, very good. Now, have you considered a chocolate game?
What?
You said vanilla game.
As opposed to vanilla, I presume.
No. You know what I'm talking about.
Captain Obvious to the rescue.
Ah, so you have a thing against any flavor other than vanilla. I gotcha. All right. That's going to make headlines.
I love chocolate. I like vanilla, too. There's also the Diplo games for Civ 4 for the people who really like to get into the role-playing stuff. And there's also, believe it or not, still at this late date, there's an Alpha Centauri demo game going. And this really nice scenario that Darsman did. Actually, even though they've only been playing for about 12 turns, I think they're pretty close to, well, not winning, but I think they've already got the upper hand.
In 12 turns.
Well, I think I read how many turns they did, right? They got some very good players on the team. And they can do it's a scenario, so they're not starting out from scratch like you would be in.
It's because normally after 12 turns, you may have built your first warrior in Civ.
Yeah, no, they're a little more advanced than that.
Oh, okay, because either they were really good players or the scenario was a little too easy, so I wasn't sure which way we were going there.
Oh, it wasn't easy. Darzan makes some pretty good scenarios, so it wasn't an easy scenario, but it's the skill of the players of the game, because, I mean, Alpha Centauri came out in 1999. They've had a few years of practice at this point. But that's pretty much everything that's going on with diplomacy games at the moment.
Thank you for the report. Next time, more dirty secrets.
A war correspondent?
Oh, getting a war correspondent? That sounds like a good idea. Thank you for volunteering.
If you have any news for us, any news tips, contact us with tips.
Head on over to apolton.net/about, look for Contact Us, or news@apolton.net also works.
And you can also PM.
Yes, you can. You'll shoot us, Dan Q, Snoopy369, and Illuminatus, one of us four, we'll get that up there.
At some point, and I think that might have been a few episodes back, weren't we talking about learning, or was that one of our cut items?
That was a cut item from one of the pilots where we were specifically looking at Civ 4 as an educational tool. Civ 4, great as educational game or not? An article on TG Daily writes that educating kids with video games is a laudable but doomed idea. Civilization 4 is one of the educational games mentioned. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I thought the article was excellent. Written by Wolfgang Gruner. Gosh, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. So I'm not going to dissect this article bit by bit, but he hits the nail on the head. In this part, I especially like saying, quote, Civilization 4 is educational as it is, but you could quite easily modify it to be even more so, bringing the Civilopedia to the fore. Even though I think he spells Civilopedia wrong. Explain more about the history of technologies. Well, kids are researching them. Explain the basics of trade, industry, and diplomacy as they play. I don't know what you guys thought of the article, but I found myself nodding in agreement more places than not.
By and large, I did the same. It makes a lot of good points. Yeah, I personally think that you say towards the end, I didn't read the entire thing, I think. You say Civ 4 is a good educational game, according to him?
Yes, Civilization 4 is educational as it is, but then he talks about bringing the Civilopedia, move beyond just the content of the game and actually delve into the information that's there and then deal with that separately or in conjunction with them actually playing the game.
Yeah, he has a point with the Civilopedia as a good source to learn. But by and large, I don't think Civ 4 is terribly educational. It's such an incredibly butchered up, simplified version of history. You don't really learn a lot about how the world worked 500 years ago.
No.
I don't think that's really true. That's what a lot of educational educators are claiming. It's a great game to learn about history, but that's just not true.
Except if you got some of the scenarios that people come up with both here and over on CFC, they put a lot of research into the history and they try to set it up as best they can in the games. If you, instead of just giving them dry facts about a certain battle, you could let them try and reenact the battle. That might actually stick more in their head than just normal, you know, they fought this battle, they went up this hill, blah, 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 you know.
Yes, actually have them play a scenario, not just kind of a free-for-all.
Right.
What I've been thinking about is actually to make school children make their own scenarios, because I think that would be very educational, to really dive into history, what happened, and how can you translate that to a game.
Do the research.
I think playing, Yes, I think that would be very educational. Playing scenarios is also a good point. You could learn something from that, but you could learn a lot more if you actually made scenarios yourself. And you could also couple that with an IT class, so you learn two things at the same time, history and IT.
Kids are a lot smarter about computers than they were even 5 or 10 years ago, so they could probably handle this.
Oh, yeah. Some of the best scenario makers for Civ 2 and also Call to Power were 12, 13-year-old kids. And I started modding the game when I was 16, so there's no reason kids can't do that. The smarter ones, anyway.
Yeah.
Some people that...
Yeah.
But the kids that, that have some skills in that department, you can make use of that.
And another great thing is, of course, I would think that most of the kids, even if they didn't play Civilization, they probably would have heard of it, or they would have heard of SimCity, and they would actually enjoy playing it, and while they're playing it, not think, I'm playing an educational game, this is so dull. Why would I even bother?
That point in the article
that
most of the education games are so boring, even littler kids playing are going, this is so dumb.
That's absolutely true, but... Again, the problem with Civ 4 is it's fun, but it's in itself not all that educational, so that kind of defeats the purpose.
Yes, I think it would be very tempting to just load up Civ and say, okay, guys, just this and this, and you know, not have any kind of structure. They can easily get very lost down the beaten path. Besides, you know, doing well to incorporate it into the curriculum, whatever your curriculum happens to be, there is also the issue of actually getting the game on the computer, and how much is that going to cost? And what's the licensing?
That's a big issue for a lot of schools.
Yeah, the budgets both here and I think elsewhere are not so great sometimes about allowing for computer things.
Right, and are there even if you were able to get the game licensed, you know, at a decent price, which I'm sure is very possible, what about the computers themselves? Are they going to be able to run it?
Well, I don't know how it works in the U.S. and Canada, but I think here in the Netherlands that should be possible, technically, anyway. PCs are not state-of-the-art, but Civ 4 doesn't require the highest standards. I don't know how it works in the U.S. and Canada.
In the U.S., in the larger urban areas, you probably wouldn't have a problem, but if you were trying to do it some small town, you know, in the middle of somewhere, it might be a problem, because they might have a lot older ones. I think a lot of our education gets the hand-me-downs. So
Yes. Canada, very similar, yes. Varies from province to province, and urban and rural from province to province as well, but as a great generalization, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's probably to an extent true here as well, except that we don't have as much countryside, small country, so.
The only thing that I probably would get on Wolfgang here is not about what you're talking about, Civ, but you talk smack about where in the world is Carmen Sandiego, and that has to stop. Okay, Wolfgang, that was a great television show. Those are great games. Okay, if you're listening, Wolfgang, bring it on.
See, that was the more fun kind that kids would actually play.
I love that.
I've never heard of
it. I knew my geography well.
You never heard of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Oh,
nope,
or Where in History is Carmen Sandiego? For
shame.
I think that's an English language kind of thing.
Ooh.
Yes, it is.
Especially if you say it's history and geography based. American history is not really all that important in the Netherlands.
Well, no, it was world history, too.
Oh, okay.
It was, yes. Yes, and you fly all around the world.
Okay. Well, yeah. We have our own TV programs that do similar things, I would expect. I don't know, checking what it does, of course.
Welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about hot issues in the forums. The Barbarian State in Civilization IV. User Peeve Alliance started this thread earlier this month, where the map in his game had one big continent where all of the civilizations eventually met and began to interact. But then, in about the 1800s, they all found two smaller continents, presumably across a large body of ocean, and the main one of these smaller continents was populated by a substantial barbarian state comprised of 9 cities of massive size, and most of them connected by railroads. Whoa.
Pretty advanced barbarians.
They've had, on Terra maps, where they've had a whole other continent to themselves, and they've built wonders and stuff, so got far enough in the game before you discover them, huh? Good to see them building railroads.
I'm sure I've seen the barbarians build the Great Wall, for example. It's always quite funny.
The barbarians build the Great Wall. Can they get out of their civilization?
I'm not too sure. I just saw a picture of it on one of the threads.
That would be
some
cool
time
if
ago.
It kept the players from coming in, because they would be the barbarians to the barbarians.
Indeed, it's all a matter of perspective. Makes you think. But I shouldn't be thinking too hard, you know. I have a note.
You were going somewhere with that before I derailed you, sorry.
I think when I think my cogs start wearing and you can hear them.
So I guess the barbarians apparently had 40 or 50 troops throughout these cities, and some of them are riflemen, so they clobbered Pete Valiant's original force. He didn't say how many units he had or what type they were or what their promotion level were or anything like that, their experience, but he eventually set up one city and then another to drive them back, and thanks to the barbarians and their railroads, he was able to make them history pretty quickly once he got those tanks rolling in there.
I thought the biggest loss, though, would be that he wouldn't get the experience for his units beyond 10.
Yeah, as if he was fighting another civ for the same space.
So, no great leaders, generals.
No, but he was able to claim new territory that they didn't think they were going to have before. I mean, they figured, you know, we're on this Terra map, we've got this one big continent, we're all here, all the numbers of the civs were accounted for, yet, oh, hello. But Peeve Alliant says, I think if the Barbs hold enough land, they should form an empire and act like one. But if the Barbarians were to form an empire, then would, by that very fact, they not be Barbarians anymore?
Well, maybe he's trying to ask for something along the lines of if the Barbarian state became advanced enough and organized enough that it could become one of the other civs that wasn't in the game initially.
I hadn't thought of that, actually. Maybe.
Do barbarians actually follow like a tech tree, or do they just get given the technologies and that kind of thing?
I think it was given the technologies, because I've had it on a Terra map where I've landed, and they've been pretty far behind, and then they must be sneaking in my camps in the middle of the night, because, like, the turn later, poof, riflemen.
Hmm.
Oh, maybe they have the Great Library wonder.
But I already built that. Wait.
Maybe.
They stole my library.
Yes, they went into your city in the night and they took it apart.
Reassembled it.
Pretty heavy sleepers, you guys. Wow. I mean, that's awfully noisy.
Why would they do that? Why?
They're barbarians.
Cultured barbarians.
Oh, and speaking of culture, Kepler63 asks if the barbarians have any civics and whether they can be influenced by religion. Can you send your missionaries there? But as Rodrigo points out, you're always at war with barbarians, so the likelihood that you'd even be able to get one into a barbarian city is, nil?
Yeah, definitely very remote.
Yeah, because if you tried to pull a stack up alongside and get all the units out of the city, your last guy would move into the city and capture it, so you couldn't do it that way.
I think the only time, as someone pointed out, that you're going to find a barbarian city with religion in it is if it wasn't their city initially and they captured it and there was already religion in there.
Yeah, but you don't want to lose a city just to recapture it, do you?
No, but you want the other civs to lose cities so you can take them.
That'd be nice.
Just take them yourself.
Then they'll get mad.
But what if I'm on the other side of the planet? It's going to take me a couple of turns to get there. Let the barbarians sack it, and I come along and turn and say, look, I've liberated your city, but we're going to keep it safe for you.
Yeah. Just give the barbarians some units as well. Help them along their way.
That's what the world builder is for. I don't like the looks of you. Let me give the barbarians a little present. Look, here's a missile.
Yeah, but no, I'm not going to push
it
far on us.
Away from you. No, don't press that button. No, don't.
Which end is the fiery end?
No, well, now it doesn't matter. The barbarians don't have any civics, to the best of my knowledge. Anyway, I mean, why would they? They have no government.
Yeah, I think even the way the barbarian scenario works, I don't think you use civics. Yeah, no, maybe you do have some. It's been a while since I played that one.
Well, they don't have capitals, so bureaucracy itself would be pretty useless as well.
State property might be useful.
Maybe instead of civics, they have savics. You won't believe they're not civics. That doesn't mean they disappear. They just become obsolete. Which very much plays into the discussion that eventually unfolds. I guess this user, Ty4JI2X, there's a mouthful, is looking for some clarification. Where plastics, obviously fur, but at the time of that discovery, he was getting fur imported from another civ, and even after discovering plastics, with his market in place, his cities are still benefiting from the fur, even a full turn after this discovery. And more curiously, not only in canceling the trade and then acquiring the resource under his own territory, I mean, that doesn't work anymore, he has no happiness, okay, so the happiness is gone, but if he then reacquires the fur in trade, happiness bonus returns. Now, I have never seen this happen. As someone else pointed out, whenever you acquire a technology that makes a resource obsolete, immediately those deals are canceled. Is that everyone else's experience as well, or...?
I've never really paid too much attention, but I presume they often do, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't paid that much attention to the trade there either.
Normally my games are over by plastic, so...
Oh, I'm sorry. You lost again? Yeah.
Yep. I only play MP, so I'm always dying.
And usually my luck is I only get one or two of a resource, and I tend to be like, mine, mine.
You know, but if you have an obsolete resource within your territory because you have reached a certain technological advancement, it's now considered obsolete, you should still be able to trade it to other civs. And then those civs who have not learned the obsoleting technology should be able to benefit from this, whether you're in single player with the AI or the multiplayer included.
I think the point was made, why is it obsolete? Is it obsolete because of social pressures to say, no, no more ivory, no more fur, or is it because it's just not useful, we've got replacements?
Yeah, there does seem to be some sort of disconnect there. Because as someone pointed out, like when plastics arrived in the real world, suddenly fur became obsolete. Nobody wanted fur anymore. Nobody could benefit from it. Nobody's happy with it anymore. That's not true.
Yeah, you still see everything's for sale. You still see fur coats in department stores. It's not obsolete. It's just maybe not so much in everyday use.
Something like wading, though, for example, that's pretty much banned now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's only like maybe a few indigenous peoples that depend on it, or it's also very limited because they're still getting something.
It's like Norway and Japan. The point is you've got oil to replace whales anyway, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that one you had something to replace it with, but there's not really anything that replaces fur as an ivory, so why do you stop getting happiness from it? Somebody's still getting happiness from it. I mean, it's not as many people getting happiness from it.
As someone pointed out, perhaps it's just the black market and... you're not able to take advantage of the black market.
It's not fair.
But Tathil the Hun talks about being able to trade resources to other civs such as coal even when they haven't the use for them yet.
Here, I want to trade you some black rocks.
Got some beachfront property as well if you want some.
And you see, ooh, this is uranium. It's shiny. Ooh.
Look, it glows in the dark.
You know, but Tathil finds this strange, but, you know, I mean, the possibility should remain open. I mean, if the AI or a human civilization, you know, depending upon what type of game we're talking about here, you know, you should be able to recognize whether or not you have a use for that resource, but if you still want to bargain for it, even though you can't use it yet, maybe in anticipation of being able to use it, so once you do have the technology, if you're just on the verge of advancing to the point where you can use it, then it's already in place. Because wouldn't it be frustrating to know that, man, I could have traded for that resource that I'm going to need in 10 turns, but then when I go back 10 turns later and I've researched that, oh, they don't have it available anymore because they've traded it off to somebody else. Curses!
Well, isn't the other option as well that you might not be able to use it, but someone else who might want it can use it? That's why you find it.
Three-way deal kind of thing. Civ A has this, needs some sort of resource, and then Civ B has it, so you get it from B and trade it to A. That way you get the trade bonus with both of them.
Excellent.
Yep.
That's why it's called a strategy game.
Well, can you spell that for me?
Well, strategy.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy. Favorite Civ 4 label civic in the tradition that has become Polycast, talking about the various civics in Civilization 4. In this episode, labor. So, what is everyone's favorite labor civic?
Slavery.
Early on, slavery. Later on, emancipation. Because it annoys the heck out of the other civ.
One I never use is serfdom.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you didn't build enough workers early enough and you need to get things up to speed, it's not worth that much.
Well, it does have low upkeep, and if you have a really large empire, that 50% speed improvement for workers, regardless of how many you have, sounds good to me.
Yeah, but it's usually a choice between that and slavery. And slavery is more useful because I can whip out more workers, I can whip out more war units, I can whip out a couple of buildings.
Yes, serfdom's really only useful if you haven't got enough workers or they've been destroyed at some point.
Yeah, I don't think I use the caste system that much either. But then I haven't played with the specialist economy enough, I don't think.
Yeah, it can be quite useful in, say, a one-city challenge where you want to get a quick scientist or an artist or something like that.
To me, like, slavery to me is the anarchy period that's usually going to have with it. I mean, yes, it's small, but the benefit of being able to sacrifice workers for production, like if it's an early game, and particularly on the higher difficulty levels, and you're being threatened or you're going to find yourself at war with someone, you may need to whip up some units very quickly that you want to keep. But otherwise, I totally bypass slavery.
And it's a good form of population control as well.
Yeah, because your capital, because you're, especially in the higher levels, your happiness cap is a lot lower. You can only get to like size 5 or so in some of them, and you have to have some way to put, you're sort of putting the excess population to good use instead of having them sit there and riot all the time.
Yeah, it's also a good way of converting food to shields or hammers.
There was one challenge map I played one time. It was a higher level, had raging barbarians, and you were playing Rome, and about the only way to survive was to keep whipping units all the time because there were so many barbarians. You could end up in a war situation like that, too.
Yeah, I've sometimes whipped so much I've got a capital city size 1.
Try to go easier on the capital city.
I had no choice.
There's an army, I know, and there's an army outside the doorstep. It's like... Well, you're going to live or die one way or the other.
One is better than none.
But ultimately, emancipation, is that what you guys go for ultimately as well?
Yeah, when everyone else has gone for it, you don't really have much choice.
Oh, wait, you mean you only switch to emancipation if the United Nations have been built and you're forced to it? Or it's just you see other people switching to it, so then you jump on board?
Oh, no, because of the unhappiness penalty. Just you get loads of unhappy people.
Yeah, and there's sort of a economy turning point when you get to printing press, where if you have villages and towns, you can generate a lot more money. And that extra growth, if you didn't have a chance to put down your cottages earlier, you can sort of help yourself catch up by your cottages and everything growing up quicker and giving you the extra money. Because usually combine emancipation with, what am I thinking of, free speech, which is also more commerce.
Right.
Yeah, the plus 2, yeah.
Yeah, so definitely we have some differences of opinion when it comes to serfdom and slavery, but I think we're seem to be agreed on the emancipation, and I think we can all agree that you got to dump tribalism ASAP.
Yeah, I always go straight for bronze working.
Something's better than nothing.
And with the caste system, I suppose, you know, depending upon the number of luxuries you have, your religion in a particular game, and the difficulty level you're on, you may want to consider a caste system, even if it's just an interim step. Even if you want to be on slavery for a while, whereas I would be on serfdom, and then you want to get to emancipation. But could help if you're worried about your bottom line. You have those unlimited scientists, artists, and merchants, but I really don't see any long-term benefit for it.
Mm. Maybe if you're running pacifism, has more use.
Yeah, if you're trying to go for a cultural win and you wanted to get those artists and settle them in the city instead of just making a great work so you could get the more culture points over a longer period of time that way.
I can already anticipate when we have our religion-civic debate. It could get interesting. Because I would gotta stick to the topic at hand.
No, not you.
No, I have to resist. Since neither of you were here for the government or the legal discussion, if you want to throw out your favorite government and legal civic, so our listeners out there know where you stand.
Representation or universal suffrage.
Wow.
That's not a decision. If you were in a really warlike game, you might, or if you were just going flat out for domination or conquest, you might use police state if you wanted to crank up the military units faster. But usually, your cities are, by the time you get that, your cities are usually developed enough that you can turn them out pretty fast anyway. It's one of those, in a crunch, you might use it.
Yeah, you'd also probably been quite specialized with your war academies and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Because indeed, we started discussing Civilization IV Civic specifically because of a thread in Appleton's forums, which was representation versus universal suffrage. And that was very much the way the discussion went, Thinman and I. So, No controversy there. Good job. No.
Although I do have a penchant for despotism.
You would.
This is not democracy.
Oh, you have been on the polls in a while. Who's your favorite dictator?
Me?
Oh.
Dan?
Yes.
What's the right answer, and I'll tell you.
And so what about legal civic?
Free speech, unless you've got a small empire, in which case bureaucracy is the best one.
Yeah,
I think.
And vassalage really only comes into play if you're doing an early war or a Middle Ages war.
Yeah, it's quite expensive, isn't it?
Side.
Yeah, with that high upkeep, yeah.
Yeah, it's like you run it while you're producing your army, and then you switch into bureaucracy after that to bring your gold cost back in the line. I don't think I've ever used nationhood.
I've used it once or twice when there's been a sneak attack in your spiritual civ, so you can go straight into it and draft some units.
Yeah, but you wouldn't, even though it's no upkeep, you wouldn't want it for a long time, though.
Mm. No, it's a very short-term specialist thing. That's why it's useful if you're a spiritual civ, so.
Excellent. I agree, ultimately. Free speech. I usually go from barbarism to vassalage, actually, and then go on to free speech. I like the early wars, because if I wait too long, I might get my butt kicked. I must have the element of surprise. Nobody would attack me this early. Oh, yes, I will.
Well, and nobody's going to know you're building up for attack when you're in vassalage. Oh, wait, they know you're in vassalage.
It's just the AI. What do they know?
Well, that's right. You don't play multiplayer. Huh? I switched to slavery and vassalage and police state. Uh-oh.
Keep changing. No one knows what you're doing.
And you can never get anything done.
Really confuse them and change the barbarism for a while.
Only if you're spiritual. There's too much messing around.
Oh, you could be a real hardcore player if you went, no, I'm going to be despotism, barbarism, tribalism, decentralization, and paganism for the entire game. I don't need no stinking benefits. I'll kick your butt without it.
It's called barbarians, isn't it?
I was going to say, I think that's a scenario.
And finally, on this week's Senate, very briefly, and someone suggested that this should have been a poll. I agree. Why wasn't this started as a poll? This would have made it much more interesting. But anyway, favorite map type in Civilization 4?
Oh, I like most of the map types I like. Depends on whether it's like a single-player game or a multiplayer game. Because multiplayer games are always better on a Pangaea, I think. Because then you get to meet everyone fairly early on. Whereas if you're playing just by yourself, it's nice to have, say, Archipelago, where you don't have to worry too much about an early rush.
Did you just say you essentially like all of them?
Yes.
So they're all winners? Oh.
They're all winners. All losers. Depends on your viewpoint.
Nobody ever says that. Oh, wait. I said that in an earlier episode about something. Uh-oh.
Except for maybe Finn. That's just a little too weird sometimes. Because it has a random placement of resources and it can be mildly odd to just completely bizarre.
Mm. Was that a coin I heard in the background?
Yeah, that was.
Is it shiny?
It is. It's a 2p coin.
Ooh.
Is the fantasy map the one that has, like, you have deserts with game on or something like that? Just a weird mix of terrain and resources.
Yeah, or, like, wine in the middle of tundra.
I prefer continents or custom continents, though, for real navy fest. I go with islands now and again, but most of the time I prefer to avoid naval warfare because, you know, I suck at it. So, I just stick to...
Be Ragnar.
I just stick to armies and later air forces. Welcome to the research lab where we explore game concepts or ideas that are not in Civilization yet, but they might be in the future.
Yes, good old nuclear war. Global thermonuclear war.
Yeah, so regular war and nuclear war. This is what Will 9 suggests, that there should be 2 degrees of war in Civ. So that when you declare nuclear war on a nation, all those that are friendly towards the nation you have declared nuclear war on have a specific negative against you for doing this, and a similar negative effect, because now you are endangering the lives of everyone on the planet by starting a nuclear conflict.
Seems reasonable to me.
Where then, on the flip side, if nuclear war is declared on you, You can fire nukes at your enemy without getting extra unhappiness or a decrease in relations.
I'm not sure about that part. There was a war, and we were started throwing them. Two, everybody mad. Well, you're not helping any, you know?
He started it.
Problem worse.
Getting into politics again.
Tack wins by default. Crap. Will 9 later clarifies that to declare nuclear war on someone, you would actually have to fire a nuke at them and not just formally declare nuclear war, which, you know, this kind of brings me to a related point and a peeve. For instance, Sam Nucky comments that wouldn't it be kind of stupid to let them know ahead of time that you were going to fire nukes at them? Yeah. I'm going to take it one step further, or one step back, depending upon your viewpoint. You should not have to formally declare war on a civilization before you start attacking them. Sure, it's an option, perhaps it's a gentlemanly thing to do, but is it really necessary for game mechanics, or any reason at all? I mean, why should that be required? I mean, what better way to say, I don't like you, than, you know, to actually...
to turn up in their city.
Actions speak louder than words.
Hey, it's not like the president of your civ nation is going to use the red phone thing and call the other guy. Go, oh, I'm so sorry. We're about to destroy you with nukes. Good day. You know. That's why they have all those things about first strike and other scenarios like that.
Or even in Civ 4, when you're at war with someone, whether they've started the war or you've started the war, and you move your mouse over to see if they're willing to talk, and it says refuses to talk, yet when you click on it, they actually do take the time to talk to you ever so briefly. They have just enough time to say, I'm too busy destroying you. But you said you didn't have time to talk, so... which is it?
It's not talking. It's insulting.
They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
They just come up with an avatar with a finger up, I think it would be fine.
That would work.
Oh, and now we have to increase the rating of the game. The ESRB doesn't think that's appropriate. Now it's only for mature gamers. Good job.
And an avatar for them.
If you have any questions for us, you can send them to, what was it, Dan?
Polycast@apolton.net. That's polycast@apolton.net.
And if you really want to humor us, send us a voicemail, and we will play it on the air.
Reach us through our Skype account, the Polycast, by using Skype yourself. The call is free. Download Skype from Skype.com, SKYPE.com. You can also phone us if you prefer. In North America, call 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, call 44-20-7871-7659. That's 44-20-7871. Polly, no profanity or hate mail, please.
Why does the mention of nuclear war in games always make me think of war games?
Well, a nuclear weapon isn't exactly peaceful.
No, the movie, Dan, the movie.
Oh, you say war games? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Tic-tac-toe. That's the one, yeah?
War Games. Oh, the movie with Matthew Broderick?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Would you like to play a game? I don't know. Is that how the computer sounded? I don't even remember. I don't even know if that was a line.
Somewhat. Actually, shall we play a game? But...
Oh. Shall we play a game? Was there that inflection there? I don't even remember.
Close. Pretty close.
Okay.
And weird again.
When did I stop? Thank you for listening to Polycast once again. We'll be back again in a couple of weeks. This time, I've been joined by Mackie, who has returned to us...
from the depths of sickness and Christmas.
And all her dates. And...
No dates.
And Anthony Christmas, known as Dolphin.
Hello. Goodbye.
We have to break out the Paul McCartney song now.
You ruined
hello,
it
hello, goodbye, for those who don't know what I'm talking
about. You say yes.
I say no.
Could do a duet.
No. Singing bad.
And I just thought I'd just quickly browse the Polycast forum here to see if there's some comment from the last episode or any additional episode that we could respond to. Not that we necessarily want to encourage some of these people.
Cast. What you should do is you should move that thread in the off-topic to the Polycast forum.
Oh, right, because I'm spamming the forums. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, they're still both up there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I just realized that. And now, live on Polycast, folks, I am now going to detop the thread. Ooh. Everybody watch closely.
I can't see from here.
There, now reload off topic.
Woo!
Look at that.
Where'd it go?
It's gone. It's magic.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for joining us today.
Pleasure, not a chore.
Did you say pleasure, not a chore, or pleasure, not sure?
Not a chore.
Oh,
sorry, right. My English accent is obviously too strong for you.
You completely cut out for me.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, me too. It's all of a sudden like, boom, if you started to speak.
Yeah, I was making my quick getaway.
Didn't work.
Has anyone ever actually phoned in or emailed or whatever it was? Because there's three links you've got, isn't there, for news for Polycast?
Nobody
has ever done that yet.
People were scared.
There has been a caller, but it was just me testing it.
Wrong number.
Record date January 19th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV and the Warlords Expansion Pack. Copyright 2007, the Bolton Civilization site at abolton.net.